Let's Talk PR and More.
Public relations, media, publicity, integrated communications, marketing, digital, reputation management, and more.
Let's Talk PR and More with award-winning PR strategist Sherry Goldman.
Hi, I'm Sherry Goldman, president of Goldman Communications Group, and welcome to Let's Talk PR and More. My guest today is Leslie Gold. Leslie is founder and CEO of Sutherland Gold Group. During her career, Leslie has launched and built some of the best-known startups today, including Zoom and Brex, and she has elevated brands and developed communication strategies for companies including TiVo, Sony PlayStation, Birchbox, Doctors on Demand, SurveyMonkey, and Madison Reed. Prior to founding Sutherland Gold, Leslie was vice president of Blank & Otis, the global technology practice of Hill & Knowlton. She's also worked in the media as a producer at CNN and in politics as press secretary to U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich. She brings all of her experience in the media, politics, and PR to craft strategies and compelling stories that help put technology companies on the map and establish leaders with influence. So I'm excited Leslie is here with us today. Welcome, Leslie.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm excited to be here. And especially after that intro, I'm like, wow, who wouldn't want me on their show?
Exactly, right? We're in PR. We know how to promote our clients.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's get started. And I know we're going to talk about thought leadership and personal branding and developing stories, but I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your background, you know, politics, media, PR. How did you pull it all together and how did you wind up in PR?
Yeah, well, and I have to say, I went to a small liberal arts college where, you know, you majored in things like women's studies and poli-sci, and, you know, you didn't really choose a career path. You really kind of expanded your mind and connected ideas. And so, you know, it's a wonderful education. It's not necessarily the best on-ramp for a career. I always knew I was going to be interested in doing something with women and media. And initially, I thought I wanted to be a journalist. And, you know, I hadn't really done any internships or anything like that. So I kind of decided I'm going to move to D.C. and, you know, kind of do political news. So I had this poli-sci background. And sort of a long story is I really couldn't get a job. And I actually had great sympathy for new college grads who enter the job market who feel like I'm ready to take on the world and yet no one wants to hire me. And so I ended up doing what most people do in D.C. I had an unpaid internship and a part-time job to support my unpaid internship. And I will tell you, nothing forces you to want to succeed in an unpaid internship as much as working at J. Crew and realizing, like, this will be my life unless I can turn this into a job. And so my lack of folding skills at J. Crew and my blunt honesty with customers quickly made me feel like I better double down on my unpaid internship, which happened to be in communications at the Democratic National Committee. And at that time, Rush Limbaugh and talk radio, it's sort of like a precursor to politics today and personality-driven pontificators were really big. And so I was sort of supposed to be the Democratic answer to get talking points and kind of a radio strategy together or help people do that. And I think in like month four or five, the entire radio department from the DNC was drafted to the White House. And I was sort of left alone with a bunch of radio equipment and not much knowledge of what to do while they looked to fill the positions. And, you know, I sort of took that as like, this is my chance to get out of J. Crew. And I made the most of it. And I kind of began to look for ways to tell stories about the legislation that we were trying to promote and get passed ultimately or support for. And I found I really liked it and was good at it. And fortunately, I was offered the head of radio. I went from being the intern to the head of radio in probably less than a year, but mostly, as I said, I really have J. Crew to thank for that because I was such a failure.
Well, congratulations. That's a great promotion.
Thank you. And I kind of, you know, since I'd always had this sort of dream to be a sort of some on air or do something in TV, I just kind of parlayed the DNC job actually into another political job working for Bob Reich. And I will say that the Bob Reich job, and this is really a note for any kind of young person starting out, you know, I fell into some of the best jobs of my life, honestly. And working for Bob Reich was a huge gift as a communicator, because anyone who knows him, or if you don't know him, I strongly suggest you follow him, listen to him, read his writing, and whether you agree with him or disagree with him, he's like a fabulous communicator. And he's a fabulous boss. And I found myself at, you know, 23, 24 years old, kind of my next 2 years was really just being at his side and kind of giving him the lowdown on his day, what he should be saying, giving him reviews of how he did. And as I said, he is incredibly kind and generous and just so intelligent that you would give him, like, you know, you give a leader sometimes like a kernel of an idea to write something, And the next day, he'd have written the whole thing. It's amazing. So, you know, I was somewhat spoiled. And, you know, he was a soundbite machine, and he was just so personable. And he probably taught me, like, it was the best education and communications anyone could ever ask for. And I'm incredibly grateful for it. And it's interesting because he helped me get a job at CNN. You're asking how I put it together. And he was, you know, he was kind of like, you've been so great. How can I help you? And, you know, he helped me. And, you know, but when I was leaving, he said, I think you're really going to miss. You know, it's one thing to kind of report on a story, but you're the one making the story. Like, you're putting, like, you know, he kind of understood, I think, before I did, how much I liked, you know, being the storyteller, you know, because that is my, the thing I gravitate to in working with leaders and brands is, like, how do you want to tell this? What are the things we should point to? Because I love stories. I love content. And there's so many different ways to tell them. And I again, I don't think I realized how much I loved that. You know, he did. And he saw that in me. And, you know, he's now out in the Bay Area, and I, you know, stayed in touch with him. And every time I see him, he's like, you're someone who loves ideas. You're just someone who, you know, like, you are the champion of ideas and getting them out in the world. And so that was, you know, if I look at the connective tissue of, you know, kind of where I started and where I am today, like, that is it. And that's the through line. And again, I feel so grateful I've had a lot of different perspectives to bring to bear when I work with different companies today.
So, I mean, that sounds perfect and ideal, and you never know where you're going to wind up. And certainly, I could appreciate that through line. I started similarly. So obviously that background helped you in PR, but one of the things I heard you say he mentioned was you knew how to tell a story, right? And that's what we do in PR, and that's what you do for your clients. How do you, identifying stories and telling them, and it may not be the story that the client thinks it is.
No, exactly. Well, and I think the thing that, and I think I brought to the Rice job, and actually when I came out here to tech, it was the same thing, as I sort of brought a perspective that was not so steeped in Democratic politics. Like, I kind of had a broader field. And I remember when we were talking about, you know, where he should tell a story and kind of who he should talk to. We had an initiative around 401ks and educating people around 401ks. And he, you know, was a very smart man. And, you know, somehow in the kind of scheduling of events and kind of, you know, the different audiences we should reach, there were a bunch of community colleges on the list, and reaching those community college students. And he was giving graduation speeches where he talked about kind of the 401k program and what starting one out at 22 would mean for you, you know, if you kept it over the course of your lifetime. And afterwards he was like, well, so how did I do? And I said, well, you were terrible, which, and he was like, what? And he was, and again, this is the great thing about being 22. Like, no one had told me that's not what you're supposed to say. So, and he's like, well, what do you mean? And literally I was 22 and kind of an idiot. And I was sort of listening to him as I was a member of the audience. And I like sort of went through all the things, like, you never mentioned it was tax deferred. Like, I don't know that. And so I think sort of the, you know, I like sometimes being the dumbest person in the room, but I feel like I had a great affinity for audiences and like early on, sort of, you know, like where everyone wants to understand like the sort of bubble. Like I was like, I kind of want to understand what's outside the bubble, like, you know, and so yeah. That was sort of a gift I had. And when I came to the tech world and I sort of came to Silicon Valley in the same way I went to DC, where I was like, I think I want to do tech. I don't know anything about it. Like, this is where I learn. And so when I came here, I didn't know anything about, you know, tech that much. And I thought I'll learn. It'll be like a kind of education in of itself. And so when I worked with companies, and TiVo was an example, you know, there was a lot of, I remember there was like sort of a whiteboard drawing about the technology, and it was so great. And like, but their big insight at the time was like, well, this is really for people who don't want to waste time watching TV. And I was like, I don't think so. I think it's for people who want to watch a lot of TV. Like the thing that's like, you know, and this is when you talk about storytelling, it really is, you know, bringing out like, what is it you think like people are going to grab onto and get most excited about? And TiVo really was a precursor for how we watch TV today. Like what was exciting about TiVo was not that people didn't watch TV. They wanted to sign up for, you know, season passes of their series. They wanted to binge TV. And so, and I think there's a combination of what's really powerful for storytellers is, and maybe it's from a consultant point of view, but like, who is the audience? Like, what do they really care about? Which is always obvious. But I think you sometimes talk about that from a marketing perspective and not from like the cultural lens perspective. And I feel like more and more today, as there's so many different touch points, like how do you, like a story is only as good as it is, like as an audience receives it. It's not just a story that you want to tell. It's what people need to hear in that moment.
Absolutely. And I will agree with you that most clients don't get it. They just don't. I mean, I was even speaking to a prospect the other day, and I said, well, who's the audience for your product? And he started describing avatars. You know, well, it's the typical Alice that would be, you know, a housewife. And like, who's the audience? I don't think they understand the audience, and they're so focused on what they think their message is that it doesn't connect. So there is no audience of everyone. They don't understand it. That's one of the things I find, and I'm hearing you're sensing similar. That was the TiVo thing.
Yeah, and I think there's just and it was interesting. I just saw Kara Swisher with Gavin Newsom last night talking about her new book, and she was talking, you know, and her book is really about kind of some of the executives she's seen over time and kind of how fame and fortune change them.
Right.
And I think there is a degree, and this has always been, when I was in Washington, it was sort of the same way, is that people get divorced from real people really quickly. And so, like, the rarefied air is kind of great that you're talking to the same people who understand things in the same way. And that's a really small subset of people, typically. Really complicated things, what's challenging, but how do you say them simply? And, like, and what is, like, the one thing? You know, it's not like the 5,000 things that this does. There's really, like, one sort of big universal truth, and that's really hard for people to get to.
So as I hear it, we really need to take a step back, or what you do is take a step back and say, what is the messages, and help them craft it from the beginning. Because even though they know their business, it's not a message that resonates with audiences. It's not a message the media is going to pick up. And you're using the media very often to help tell your story.
Yeah. And I think there's like the, usually to me is like the insight, or, you know, and I like to call it the culture around the company, you know, and more now you see like there's a really distinct culture usually among your employees. And there's like, you know, a way to begin to sort of mine and tell that story for that audience versus a different type of audience. But I think sort of understanding, you know, the sort of overarching story, even before you get to message, but like, what is that really big insight you have? And then turning it to story is more of that art. But it really, really is sort of like, who are the distinct people? It's not like the person I talked to at the conference. And as I said, I think the biggest struggle we all have, and I mean, we talk about it on a business level, but you can see it like in politics or culture every day, like, it's getting harder and harder to talk to people who don't think exactly like you. And to me, like, that's the saddest thing as a storyteller. And so, you know, how do you begin to get people to expand their mind and believe in what you're trying to kind of get them to believe? So that's, you know.
And how do we do that? I agree with you. That's a real challenge because of a fragmented media, because of how they get their information. And we've just become a society of not a lot of gray. You're either black or white. There's nothing in the middle.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and again, the worst thing about sort of the media landscape today is that you can just subscribe to exactly the kind of narrow world, like it's a narrow cast world versus a broadcast world. And when that was first presented to us, we were like, oh, that's great. It's the democratization of, you know, we thought it was a democratization, and really it was like the end of democracy.
You know, because basically, you just had people.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, and so again, I think it's the desire, and I think it's, you know, not all companies want to do that, but is to begin to like, how much do I care about what people other than me think or do? And as I say, like, we it's interesting. We have all these listening tools now to like have brand listening, and, you know, and people don't want to listen. And so I think when you're saying like, what is the very first thing that you can do as a storyteller or as a communicator, is like, learn how to listen, because you can't communicate if you don't understand, again, what people need to hear and want to hear. And then there's the art of how you shape that so they are engaged. And, you know, you only get to engagement after you have some form of understanding. As I said, I think there's lots of different ways to do that, but that is a step a lot of companies either don't do well, or they feel like they've already had it, or they're getting a bad signal. Like, you know, we love talking about, you know, product market fit, and we like to talk about story market fit at SG, but it really is. And you know, for young companies, a lot of times, like, those truly early adopters, like, they're not the best signal. They're just a signal.
No.
But again, like, that's a lesson you learn over time. And I love working with, you know, sort of, and I've been fortunate enough to to work with startup founders who are repeat founders who've done that. And as I said, they kind of know that. But in the beginning, you're just like, this is the only signal I have. And so we can't question it. It's, you know, God's truth.
It's crazy. Let's take a step back. You've given me so much to ask you about. I know you said you call CEOs the storyteller in chief for a company and brand. So I loved when I heard that. So, and I think that kind of dovetails into what you were just saying about listening. So what do you mean by that? And how do we then help them listen? Because if they are the storyteller in chief, they need to make sure that they will be effective in that role.
Yeah, no, and I think it's really interesting. I mean, certainly for younger companies, I think this is kind of well known at this point, where you sort of have your founding story. Like, you know, they begin to get used to, like, most CEOs, at least coming from tech in the early days, like, that's sort of how they launch. You know, they all right. have that story. You know, and so beginning, I think the next challenge for them, though, is kind of begin to expand, like, what is their role as the storyteller? So if you have, like, a certain phase where, you know, being the storyteller in chief is like the founding story, it's the way to, like, it's almost like you're on the campaign trail, I like to say it. And so you have a lot of CEOs who are great campaigners, and they have a great stump speech. And then, like, once they're in office, they kind of lose their way. So I think it's beginning, as you begin to expand the bench, and this is, I'd say, primarily the kind of work we're doing today. And because, as you've read my lengthy bio, a lot of the CEOs I work with now are people who are, you know, in charge of public companies or much bigger companies than when maybe we started, and beginning to find, like, you know, what is the role what do I do now with my platform? Because I have people who can talk about product. I have, you know, and I want to begin to craft more of a legacy and have more of a voice. And I think that is, you know, sort of the next kind of, you know, big mountain those CEOs can climb. It's like, I've outgrown my founding story. I'm bigger than my founding story. I'm not just a corner office piece. Like, I have things to say and beginning to choose those spots.
So I assume that's the established leaders with influence kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, and I to me, we have, you know, now, like, I feel like there's like an eye roll among communications professionals and almost in a room with CEOs, and like, what's our thought leadership plan?
Oh gosh. Like, in some ways, they're going to do LinkedIn.
it's become like so inauthentic. It's troubling to me. And I'm like, never in the history of communications have there been so many people talking and saying nothing. And I feel like that's kind of been in vogue right now. It's like, let's just not offend anyone. You know, like, you know, that, and that is kind of, you know, where communications is, because you're so afraid that there's not a lot of courage in the stances that leaders take today. And there's not even that much authenticity. And so I'm hoping that comes back. And I think there's, you know, probably a movement to do that and leaders who want to do that, but it's a fraught time because, you know, there's so many mechanisms for sometimes the vocal minority to be very, very vocal. And that changes what you want to say. It goes again, you know, like, I'd rather not risk anything than say something.
I do think social media has given everybody a platform and really just amplified some craziness out there. There's no question.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I go back to Washington and, like, the things I've learned, because what I, like, technology changes and, like, the sort of, you know, medium of the day changes. People don't change. Like, that is, like, and that's why, again, there's books like Wired for Story. Like, story is so effective. It's like, in all the technology change, humans are the constant. And so kind of understanding that and kind of how that works is really, again, I think I have great faith that, you know, leaders will stand up and, you know, they just have to get comfortable, like, with the fact that, again, this goes back to the Washington truth, is that, you know, you can kind of judge me by the quality of my enemies. And there used to be all these case studies on brands that, like, the really successful brands, like, knew not just who their customers were, but who they were willing to offend, because, you know, that was part of their brand. And I think that's kind of leaders at some point, be like, you know, you can judge who I am by who doesn't like me as much as who is with me. And that way, when there is a negative comment, there's not like, what do we do? Like, let's mitigate all negativity. Because if there's no negativity from anybody, it really means you're not saying anything that powerful. Because, you know, typically people who are not in agreement won't say stuff. So I think it's a balance, but you really do have to be like, not just who am I for, but who am I against? Like, who is it? This is, you know, this might not, I believe in this so much that I'm willing to say it, even if it's not what you want to hear. And I do, and maybe I'm an idealist, but I think people admire people with convictions. And this goes back to Bob Reich, and I don't always agree with him, but I really admired and still do that, like, he stayed the course. Like, the things he believed in 25 years ago, he's still championing today.
Right.
And, like, and he, you know, and again, if you, he's just taken to every different form of media, and I think great leaders do that. Like, they pick things, they're not just championing things for 5 minutes in a tweet or a reaction. It's like, change takes time, and I'm willing to put it in there, and I think people respect that.
So you've counseled a lot of startup companies. Is that something the CEO, and you need to work with them at the beginning? Is that something that happens later on in their growth phase? Is that, can you change that? Help us understand, because that's so much of what you do.
Yeah, and I it goes back to authenticity. Like, there are some, I mean, there are some CEOs from day one, like, they are like that. They're like, I'm crusading for these things. They're not many, though, because I do think, you know, if you're a startup founder, you're sort of fighting for your life.
And your funding,
really
Yeah,
I mean, your funding is your life. So I think that's sometimes, like, you know, your principles, you know, your principles are not the things you can start on day one. You might have them, but I don't think we're standing so much, like, they don't come out. I think those are something, as companies get more mature, as the bench gets deeper, you begin to see that. I mean, they may have always been there, and they may have been planting seeds, but just not as fundamental to your strategy. Because, again, a lot of startups, and especially if they're disruptive, it's a brand new technology, there's so much explaining to do about kind of what is this, why we need it, how it's different, that there's a little bit less of that. And again, I want to just be careful, because sometimes there's a very unique story. You know, maybe it's an immigrant founder. Maybe it's, there could be some lesson. Like, I remember Enrique from Brex had very early on, and Brex was probably not your typical startup because it was very well funded pretty early on. But he was pretty vocal early on at Brex about immigration issues. And that was something that was very important and part of his personal story and journey that he authentically could speak about. You know, and that's, you know, something that I look to Matthew Prince at Cloudflare. And I remember just kind of, he's another, like, amazing communicator. Like, again, you're sometimes you, as a communications or a professional, you're like, God, I'm learning so much from this person, because he's, like, just so naturally good at it, or she is. But he was really, really thoughtful about the First Amendment, kind of ahead of its time. Like, I think that issue is something now more and more, especially as we look at elections and kind of what the social platform should do. But I just remember he very authentically, you know, and pretty much on his own, which I was saying I could take credit for, but it was like, you know, something he was grappling with and somewhat publicly, so that when questions came up around what Cloudflare should do, he had, like, a body of work and kind of thinking that he could point to that showed the kind of progression of his own thoughts on these issues. You know, and again, as I said, I think that's very different than today's world, where you just see, like, kind of, you know, the armchair tweet kind of coming out at you, as opposed to, like, the thinking that you can follow.
Yeah, I think it's probably vetted by too many lawyers, and you're right, not to offend anybody, and communications people, it's easier, I think, I'm a consultant, you're a consultant, we're on the outside, to say things to our clients that perhaps if you're internal and you are more junior, you might not feel comfortable saying to your CEO for fear of losing your job or...
Well, and I love, you know, you just mentioned lawyers, and I think there was that moment in, like, the communications world after the hearings of the college presidents where we're like, see, and this is why you listen to communications people.
Was that not a debacle?
Not lawyers. Right. And I think, and that's an example where, you know, you're trying so hard not to offend anyone that you offended everybody. And, like, you know, that there was just, and I thought, we'll see how things change after that, because I know, like, every comms person is like, it's us and the lawyers battling it out to see what we can say. So that was interesting, I think, for everyone to sort of witness and see well-intentioned people with bad communications can really create a show.
They can. Is the media making it worse, Leslie, because they are so gotcha? I mean, they're looking for a company CEO to fumble, or they're looking to find something that you said that maybe – oh, if we think of it hard, it could have offended someone or could be wrong because they're looking for that gotcha moment. Is it harder today to make CEOs have influence and get those messages out from your perspective?
Well, I think that more than, you know, the media, you know, is struggling with its own business model. And so
sure.
I think they're incentivized to write about companies and leaders that guarantee eyeballs. And so I think the biggest thing I've shipped that most people notice is that if you're not someone, you know, like a Facebook or an Amazon or someone someone's already heard of, they're much less likely to do a story. Or you're not, if you don't have a celebrity attached to you. Like, there's got to be a name attached that we already know. So that's one. I think the negativity, you know, and I know some people are like, oh, the media is just all negative now. I say this, I was at CNN, and I can tell you, like, most people like to read, you know, a teardown story more than like, ah, oh, isn't this great story? You know, like people
sad.
Used to call CNN the Sky is Falling Network. Remember, it was like always like breaking news. Like, you know, you show the breaking, like, oh no, what's happening? Like, so people pay attention more and tend to be more engaged. It's like Schadenfreude, like, ooh, I love seeing a good teardown. And we used to say, you know, the media builds you up just to tear you down. And I don't think that's a new thing.
No.
I feel like that was an old thing. So, you know, we just have much fewer companies that people, like, there are fewer reporters, and so there's fewer companies that those bigger outlets write about. I think on the amazing side, and this kind of goes, like, this proliferation of, like, newsletters, and as I said, just the way there is this kind of narrow cast, there is the opportunity to kind of begin to influence and reach people and write different types and create different types of content across different vehicles. So I think, like, there's just a much narrower focus on that kind of very mainstream media, on the kind of business stories they want to do.
It makes it more challenging for us. We're almost out of time. So one last question.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Wow,
it went
that
fast.
Was so fast, Sherry. I'm a talker.
As am I, Leslie. We could do this for hours.
Oh, yeah. We should have our own show.
Exactly. What advice could you give people, either starting out or students or uni professionals who are going, I want to give the right counsel to my CEOs. I want to, you know, put them in the right place. What should they know? What skills should they hone? What should they do?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. Everyone starting out in communications wants to do counselor strategy.
Oh, they all do.
And I think if it were that easy, you know, great. But I kind of came to Silicon Valley, and I'd probably been working, you know, before I went to Blanca Notice, I was almost, I don't want to say how old I was because it just ages me unnecessarily, but I had had some pretty big jobs. I'd been a producer at CNN. I'd been a press secretary. And when I started at my agency, I was a senior account executive. And so I look at today's world as like kind of everyone wanting promotions and how they do that. I had a lot of real world experience and not such great experiences, right? Like, I had people yell at me. I had some great bosses, but it was like, those were very stressful environments. And I was somewhat battle tested, and I got to watch and learn a lot. And so one thing early on, I would say, listen, you know, listen all you can, like, to as many people around you, to like find a mentor. There was a guy, a visiting professor from Yale at the DNC when I was there. His name was Ed Lazarus, and he was, you know, a political operative. But he was, again, like, super gracious with his time. And, you know, he kind of was like, Leslie, if you ever have an idea, if you want to bring, like, it was almost like having office hours where I could
fabulous.
Just walk in, you know. And he was, like, again, just, like, very generous. I mentioned Bob Reich. Like, I think being willing to kind of take advantage of the people who can teach you. And I don't see enough of that, you know, where people are like, I think everyone wants to come to the table knowing everything. And I think being like, I don't know anything, you know, and I'm willing to like show you that was almost, again, a real strength. So it's like, listen, learn, you know, put yourself in different experiences. You know, that was something I worry. I mean, I have kids now, and, you know, they'll be looking for jobs, not, you know, not too far from now. But I feel like having had all these different experiences early on kind of gave me a unique perspective where I could come to the table and be different than other people. So I would be like, don't be afraid of kind of having lots of different experiences as opposed to taking a linear path. Because as a communicator, that just allows you to be like, understand a whole bunch of different pockets of people that you can, you know, kind of bring to the table and begin to do your craft.
That sounds perfect. Leslie, thank you so much for being here today. I so love talking to you.
No, me too. Thank you so much. This was a highlight.
Thanks. That's Let's Talk PR and More for today. You can find more information about the show and about me at Goldman Communications Group's website, www.goldmanpr.net. And if you want to hear this show again, you can listen to the podcast, which is posted on Goldman Communications Group's website, as well as on your favorite podcast sites, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, and iHeartRadio. Thank you again for listening. I look forward to talking PR and more with you all again next week.